history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, brought to you by Paul Everett's RV Country, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are some seemingly ordinary Americans around you with extraordinary stories to tell. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we don't forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, we learn a lot. We're educated, we're always entertained, and so often inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. And the 75th anniversary of Pearl Harbor is almost upon us. December 7th will mark 75 years from that date, which certainly has lived in infamy. And we're going to meet a man who was there, who experienced it firsthand on one of the ships that was most devastated by that surprise Japanese attack. We are in Albany, Oregon today, city of about 50,000, beautiful spot. There's rivers around here, fall colors are going everywhere, and seems like a place that David Russ Russell has enjoyed for a long time. What do you like about living in Albany, Russ, aside from the fact that you got the most unique Christmas tree I've ever seen in your front yard here?
Yeah, that's a monkey puzzle tree.
A monkey puzzle tree.
It's beautiful, isn't it? And a lot of people stop to see it.
Well, do you hang lights on it, or is it too
Hardly.
Big for that?
Very stickery.
I was going to say, you'd look more polka-dotted than the tree would after trying to hang lights on that thing.
Hey, firm.
What have you enjoyed about living here for the last 50-plus years?
It's one of those cities where you're welcome, and people are so friendly.
Where you grew up is a far different place, a far different climate, far different landscape. Auburn, Nebraska. How big a place was that?
It's a little town of 2,000. With a lot of lightning and thunder.
Gets a little windy out there?
Very windy. You flew kites in March because we had wind.
You probably hear the corn stalks rustling when it gets windy, huh?
You can hear that corn grow.
You can hear the corn grow?
Yes, it grows so fast that the humidity back there caused that corn to grow, I think. I don't know. But
how would I recognize the sound of corn growing? What does it sound like?
You can just hear it real, when you're out there. You can just, maybe it's the wind making it. But
yeah, like Rice Krispies or something, a little snap, crackle, pop.
There you go.
And what was your childhood like there? Did you have brothers and sisters?
I had two brothers and a sister. Both of them were in the military during World War II. One was Navy and one was Coast Guard.
Your growing up years, you're 96 now, so if I do the math, you're a pretty young boy when the Great Depression hits America. What were those years like for your family? What are the things you remember?
Hungry. We were always hungry. In fact, we had to grind our own wheat or corn. We ate a lot of beans. Most of the people were on welfare. The welfare would give you a few potatoes, rice, raisins, lard, sugar.
Something tells me you probably had to work at a pretty young age.
We had a lot of chores to do when we were kids. As soon as we got out of school, if we didn't do our chores, you know what happened to us.
What's that?
We got a whipping.
Uh-huh. With the belt or the switch or what?
Well, sometimes a belt and sometimes a switch, and that's no fun.
So you were ready to get out of there and get in the Navy, I guess, eventually.
I was ready.
Do you remember in those years some dreams, some ambitions, some thoughts of, hey, when I grow up, I'm going to do this and this and this?
I wanted to join the Navy. I wanted to get away from that little community. Sometimes I'm dreaming about that or thinking about it when I go back to bed. For some reason, you go back to your childhood days. You think back, like, after the Pearl Harbor deal and yeah, the war years, you know, think some of the things you forgot about. It comes back to you.
I'm sure some of those memories are haunting, and it's not easy to think about it, not easy to deal with. Why the Navy? What was it about the Navy that made you want to join?
My dad had a friend who was a Navy man. He was in the Army with my dad. And then after World War I, he joined the Navy, and he'd come and visit my dad a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And I think probably the uniform at that time.
You liked the Navy uniform better than the Army?
Yes.
Thought the ladies would like it better?
That I don't know.
You mentioned your father serving in the Army in World War I. Did he ever tell you about any of that, the things that he did?
He told me a lot. He had his own horse at the time. It's something about the Rainbow Division. I don't know too much about it. But I remember him talking about dead horses. He saw so many dead horses when he was in the Army over there.
But you get this idea of joining the Navy, and you did so a long time before Pearl Harbor, more than 2 years before Pearl Harbor.
Yes.
What were those early days for you like in the Navy? What kinds of things did you do? Where did they send you?
After I got aboard ship, I was assigned to the 5th Division, which is the starboard side of the boat deck. Our duties then was to hoist boats in and out, and when we were underway, if they flew a seaplane, we were to retrieve it. And we had a sled with a cargo net on the back of it, and this pontoon had a hook on it. And when we'd make a real hard turn, the rough sea would turn really smooth, and then this aircraft would land in the water and slide up on that sled and fell back till it hit that cargo net, and then we'd hoist it aboard. We got up at 5:30 in the morning. We'd scrub down the decks, washed the wash paint work, shine the bark work. And then we'd go down for breakfast. And then 8 o'clock, turn two again, then go back up and fight the rust. All ships, a lot of rust, you know, the salt
sure.
water.
And this is the ship you're talking about here is the battleship USS Oklahoma?
Battleship Oklahoma,
And your uncle was on that ship.
He came aboard after I was on there. We were in San Francisco at the time at Hunter's Point, and he came aboard. That was in September, I think.
September of 41?
41, yeah.
Well, that had to be pretty special to have your uncle aboard. Not everybody has that.
Well, when I went broke, I knew where to go get some money.
And I guess we're so used to modern times, and of course it was World War II that gave us that policy after the 5 Sullivan brothers went down, but people aren't used to family members serving on the same ship or in the same unit. There were 23 pairs of brothers that died on the USS Arizona on December 7th. I interviewed a man here years ago who lost one of his brothers on the Oklahoma but survived, and here you're on the Oklahoma with your uncle. And what about all the other guys? What was the camaraderie like aboard that ship?
We had all our seamen were from different parts of the world, you know. We had people with Germans. We had Russians.
Really?
Yeah. We had people from all different states. I think we had every state in the United States, all those guys. And the Southerners, we had quite a few Southerners.
So pretty eye-opening for a young man from Nebraska to interact with all these guys.
Everything was different.
How about where you were stationed there at Pearl Harbor? Did you get to enjoy that island paradise a little bit?
Oh, yeah. We had sunshine every day, and the weather was perfect. We would operate during the week and come in on the weekends. Just before the war, we were our exercise was to take gun crews from other ships out, and we'd do a lot of firing, AA firing.
So you'd have a lot of practice.
We had a lot of practice.
But did you have any idea that a war was coming?
I saw my uncle was in the Air Force in Honolulu the night before. That was Saturday night.
And to be clear, this is a different uncle. So you've got an uncle that's on the ship with it. You also have another uncle stationed at Hickam Field just a few miles away. So you ran into him, the Air Force uncle.
That was my dad's brother also. He told me that, he said, we'll be at war within 12 days.
Really? So when he told you that, was that kind of a smack in the face? Was that a big eye-opener?
Well, they were talking about war because they were talking, they sent those dignitaries from Japan to Washington, D.C., and that was the big, you know.
Yeah.
That was the news in those days.
Right. They were there when Japan attacked you guys at Pearl. But did you believe him when he told you that? Did you think he knew what he was talking about?
The way the world was then, you know, after what Germany was doing, dominating everything they can get their hands on, is one of those things you think about, you know.
But when you went to sleep on Saturday night, December 6th, I'm sure you had no idea what you were going to wake up to the next day.
I thought we'd just go to work and do our work and have a holiday routine.
What really happened? What do you remember about that morning?
I was in the compartment just reading a book, and Lieutenant Rommel gets on the loudspeaker. He says, this is attack, fellas. And he didn't say this. He said that S word. And boy, that woke us up. And about that time, those torpedoes start hitting us. And pow, 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 pow. The 9 of them hit us.
And where were you?
I was in the compartment. And those torpedoes just hit me, probably 80 feet from me and just across from me there.
So what did that feel like?
Oh, my goodness. You know, as clean as those ships were, dust. I don't know where the dust came from, but it probably come from the blowers, the air blowers. You start coughing, so much dust. It's unbelievable.
Well, it sure seems like there's nothing that could prepare you for this. And you're trying to figure out what in the world's going on, probably, right?
Yeah, what do I do next? When he said air attack, I had 2 battle stations. If we came under air attack, I was to sink cover. I had to go down below decks, below the armor decks. And if we go to surface action. My battle station was the 5-inch 51s. They were in casemates alongside the ship.
Uh-huh. So where'd you go?
So every day I went down below decks. And I went down. That hatch I went through is 13.5 inches thick armor plate. From 13.5 inches down to 8 inches, 3/4 inch length of the ship. And they started to close the hatch, and I said, well, you know, my mind started operating, and I said, I've been trained to be a first loader on any aircraft gun. In case somebody gets hurt, I can replace them. And by the time I got out of that ship, it was halfway over. Yeah, it began to capsize, you know, right away.
Yeah. You said the number, 9 torpedoes, and that ship
several
starts...
Several bombs, yeah.
And it's starting to turn over, ends up tipping over something like 150 degrees, right? I mean, almost completely...
And,
upside down.
And trying to get out of those compartments, you know, people were dogging, you know, they dog everything down those hatches. There's 8 dogs on every hatch. It's not like these quick disconnect hatches that we have today. But I would try to undog them. Somebody else on the other side would dog them down. And then I had to climb over lockers. The concussion or the explosions caused those lockers to break loose. So I had to divert myself around to get out or climb over the lockers.
Could you see? Was it dark under there?
We had portholes when I got up on the main deck there, and they were still open.
Right, but you had to get up there first. So you're scrambling over fallen lockers. There's probably is there water rushing in too?
See, we had battle lanterns also.
Right.
When we locked last Tuxedo, the battle lanterns went on.
Mm-hmm. I imagine there's just chaos all around you probably, right? You have other guys that are trying to figure out what they're trying to do or where they're going?
Well, it was pretty well organized. You know, we used to well train. We had no problems, you know, people up starboard and down port.
Have you ever stopped to think about what if I hadn't made that decision to go topside when I did?
Those men are still down there. Yeah, they got trapped, yeah.
And of all the ships at Pearl Harbor, only the Arizona lost more men than the Oklahoma.
429 we lost. Mm-hmm. A lot of my friends. Mm-hmm.
What was going through your mind while this is happening?
Oh, everything goes, why did Japan do this, you know? Why? Because those warlords in Japan, they were different.
So when you did get to the surface or to the top of the ship, it's already starting to roll over?
The water just began to come over the main deck there. And the ship was, about 80 degrees,
mm-hmm.
about ready to capsize there.
So if you're on the top, you're really on the side with the way the thing is turning.
Yeah, the deck is facing you, yeah.
Uh-huh.
The water hose coming across, I grabbed a water hose and just hand over hand myself up. Oh, then I went down over the side.
Because the ship's turning, you're basically climbing to get to what was the side, which is now the top, and then you slid off into the water?
No, the half-inch thick steel plates,
uh-huh.
They were riveted together, so I just went down, I got a hold of the edge of that, and I just gave one big leap, and I caught a line from the Maryland. We were tied alongside.
Uh-huh.
And I got a hold, see, there was fire coming down between the two ships.
Right.
From the Arizona, and I didn't want to get that water because I'm afraid that, you know, the way the wind was blowing that fire down, I thought, oh my, you know, I could see those guys walking in that fire and swimming in it, trying to push that oil away from them, but they just couldn't do it. But anyway, I called up on the Maryland, and they were at general quarters. They're firing their 1.1 guns, anti-aircraft guns, so I just over there and I wanted a few instructions on how to handle that ammunition, and I got it, and so I helped them pass ammunition.
I'm just thinking about this. So you were, 21 years old? Yeah, 21 years old.
I just turned 21. Uh-huh.
Uh-huh. And your ship has been almost sunk by now. It's about to go under.
Just the bottom of it sticking out. Uh-huh.
And you've escaped that. You've got, you know, the water's on fire, basically, because all the oil from these other ships.
The fire was on the inboard side by the beach.
Uh-huh.
Between the two ships.
And there's all this, you know, everything else is going around here, too. I mean, the Arizona has had the big explosion. I'm sure there's smoke everywhere.
Oh, awful, yeah.
What are you hearing? What are you smelling?
The smoke. You could smell the smoke. Mm-hmm. Since I was down in the compartment, I didn't see the Arizona explode.
Right.
But I did see the destroyer Shaw when it went up in smoke.
Which was a more spectacular explosion.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
The photos of that are probably some of the most striking photos out there. It looks like fireworks going on.
Oh, that's right. Mm-hmm. So I want to tell you another story.
Yeah.
At 7 o'clock in the morning, a high-test gasoline tanker for the fuel for the aircraft tied up just ahead of us. Nobody attacked that ship.
What would have happened if they did?
Oh, probably, I don't know. That high-test gas, you know how explosive that is.
Yeah, that's almost miraculous that it...
Oh, you're right.
I'm just trying to imagine being in your shoes, and I mean, you tell me that you go over to the Maryland and you jump into action and help them load ammunition for this big gun, but did you have any concept of what was really happening there or what had happened to the world?
Well, we knew we would go to war as soon as we'd sit around and just waiting for our orders to come in, where to go. We'd sit around talking about, what are they going to name this? Are they going to name this Pearl Harbor? So it turned out to be Pearl Harbor, yeah.
How long did that last with you helping them with that gun on the Maryland?
Not too long. Then from there, the Maryland wanted the Oklahoma sailors to leave, so I went over on the beach. And from the beach, I went up to the administration building. And that's when I got to see all the burnt. They were in the administration building. They just laid them in there.
Dead bodies.
Some were dead and some were dying. But most of them wanted to smoke, and I didn't smoke. So there was a Gee-Dunk stand there in the center. We call it Gee-Dunk stand, the place where they sell ice cream and cigarettes and stuff like that. And I went over and got a pack of cigarettes and some matches, and I lit their cigarettes for them.
That was your way of helping to console people who...
I didn't have any money, so I felt guilty doing what I did, but it was for a cause.
How hard was that to see? I mean, this is the human cost of war right in front of you.
When you see that flesh, it's awful. Yeah, it's... Not fun. You feel like you wish it was you instead of them. Yeah.
But since it wasn't you, we have you to tell us the story, and we're so thankful that you're doing that today. It's time for our first break, but we'll go back to Pearl Harbor when we come back. And before we're done, we're going to find out which other December 7th proved unforgettable for this 96-year-old. And we'll get a taste of his honor flight journey to the National World War II Memorial. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. If you'd like to sell your low-mileage, well-maintained RV in excellent condition, bring it to Paul Everett's RV Country, and they'll sell it for you. That's right. Consignments are welcome. Any type of motorhome, travel trailer, or fifth wheel. With 8 locations in 5 states, there's probably a Paul Everett's within driving distance of this radio station. Helping RVers get the most out of their RVs is another one of those things that make doing business with Paul such a unique pleasure. Paul Everett's RV Country in Fresno and Indio, California, Bullhead City, Arizona, Laughlin, Nevada, Coburg, Oregon, and 3 locations in Washington, Fife, Milton, and Mount Vernon. For the exact locations, go to the website. That address is rvcountry.com. That's rvcountry.com. Over 55 years of experience and 1 million RVers served. Paul Everett's RV Country, proud supporters of Hometown Heroes.
Proudly presented by Paul Everett's RV Country. This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and today's conversation with 96-year-old Pearl Harbor survivor David Russ Russell of Albany, Oregon, originally from Nebraska and a survivor of the USS Oklahoma. The battleship sunk by the Japanese on December 7, 1941, with the loss of 429 men. In all, more than 2,400 Americans died that day, and Russ witnessed some of the worst of it. Before the break, he told of stealing cigarettes from a nearby stand to fulfill the dying requests of some of the men who, it became clear, were not going to survive. And Russ, once it started to sink in there, what had happened, how did that make you feel? Did it make you angry?
Yes. And back then, everything is kill a Jap, remember? Everything advertising was kill a Jap. Now, it's altogether different. They're the greatest people on earth, as far as I'm concerned. Mm-hmm. I really enjoyed the Japanese people.
But at the time, it's wow.
Well, at the time, you know. But look what happened in Germany. The little community I was from, mostly Germans.
Oh, sure, in Nebraska.
My great-grandfather was German, so.
So you see all these who've been killed, who've been wounded, and then you look out and you see your ship and it's upside down.
Yeah, no home, no place to eat, no clothing, no showers.
Everything you had is on that ship. So what'd you do?
after I left Fort Island, I went over to the receiving station and checked in because I knew they'd reassign us someplace. So we'd look at the every day they post on the bulletin board the names of people where they'd be assigned. So about the third or fourth day, the ship that I went aboard, it was still at sea at the time. So I think on December, I can't remember the date, but it was quite a while after that the ship came in. And I still didn't have anything to wear. And I had sort of looking for handouts to eat at the receiving station there.
Wow. And you had mentioned you had an uncle on this ship. When did you find out what happened to him?
Well, my uncle from Hickam Field, he and I were visiting there on the receiving station, and pretty soon I saw my uncle walking up from the submarine base, and he had whites on. As soon as I saw him in whites, I knew what had happened. Because, see, they were just covered with oil when they took him out.
Mm-hmm.
And in those days, the uniform was shorts. And when you have whites on, you know, back when the war started, you knew what happened.
Well, and then he told you what happened to him.
And that's...
Could you believe what he went through? Can you share that story with us?
I don't know. If you have claustrophobia, you wouldn't want to hear it. Yeah, the upside down and no lights. Can you imagine? And you're just waiting for that water to build up and the oxygen disappearing.
And this could have happened to you. Not gone up when you went up.
Could have, yes.
So he's trapped in a ship that's turned over and... Compartments are filling up with water. He's running out of oxygen. How long was he down there?
30 hours.
30 hours. And then they cut him out.
And no lights.
No lights. And plenty of guys around him who are hurt, who are wounded, who are dead.
Yep. Floating around, yep.
What did that do to hear him tell that story to you?
My uncle, it was pretty hard on him. When we got into service action, he sort of went to, he was shell-shocked.
How could you not be going through that?
Yeah. And so they had to discharge him, yeah.
And I don't know if you can give us this perspective or not, but you've been an Oklahoma survivor for 75 years, and you've talked to a lot of other guys who are on your ship. You've got books about it. You know the story as well as anybody. How amazing, how remarkable, how unlikely is it that your uncle and almost another 36 guys did survive for that long in a capsized ship?
It's hard to believe. And the way they survived was they tapped on the bulkhead to see if there was any water in there or not to find out what compartment they wanted to go into before. But as soon as they opened the hatch to go into another compartment, it started filling up too. But that's how they survived from compartment to compartment, yeah.
Can you give us a sense of what you saw? You told us about what you saw at the administration building there when they're bringing the dead and the wounded. But if you looked out at Pearl Harbor, that panoramic view, when this is all over, what did you see there?
You still see what happened those days back then. I still picture the Oklahoma capsized there and the fire from the Arizona and the ship settled down. You know, and they just settled down in the 45 feet of water, yeah. But I still see it today, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Was that devastating? What did it feel like?
Oh, my goodness, yes. You wanted to do something, which we did. I'm pretty proud of that ship I was on, that little destroyer. They're little greyhounds, but they sure get around. a lot of high speed.
Well, we're going to hear that ship's story, too. Were you asked to get involved at all in the cleanup efforts?
No. We had no way of, no clothing to wear. We had nothing.
Well, maybe that's a good thing that you didn't have to take part in that.
That could be, because who wants to clean up that plasma, you know?
And you made the statement earlier that the 429 who died on the Oklahoma, a lot of those guys were your friends.
Yeah, I went through training with some of them, yeah. Uh-huh.
Is that something you knew immediately, or was that something that over the days that followed, you'd find out one at a time?
Just one at a time. Uh-huh. Just seeing some of the old shipmates, you know, from other ships, or especially destroyers tie up together, you know, and I get to see some of the old shipmates. Uh-huh.
So how did you deal with that? I mean, emotionally, to get this news over and over again, that guy's gone, that guy's gone, that guy's gone.
Yeah, I know. It's devastating, but you adjust. It's just everything's adjustment, you know.
We've seen the images from Pearl Harbor. We've seen the poster that was all over America afterwards with the tattered flag and the smoke going past and Remember Pearl Harbor. We've heard the song, yeah. Sammy Kay Orchestra, Remember Pearl Harbor. Can you help us understand, though, how palpable that feeling was in that immediate aftermath of just how motivated you and all those other servicemen were to do something about it?
Oh, my goodness. That's quite a question to ask.
I mean, do I have that right? Is that what it felt like?
Yeah, it's about it, yeah. Mm-hmm. Devastating, like you said. And I can imagine what my folks were thinking.
Because they didn't know what happened to you.
They didn't know what happened to me. Before I got a letter home, I can't remember what it was, but it's been a while. Mm-hmm.
So they're back there in Nebraska, and they hear on the radio probably Pearl Harbor's been bombed, and they know that's where you are.
Yeah, everybody, my mom said everything was silent back, and nobody moved. Everybody stayed close to the radio.
And then they may have even gotten the news that the Oklahoma had sunk and still didn't know what happened to you, probably.
They still didn't know, yeah. Right? And then, well, you know darn well, they knew that a lot of people died on those ships. Every ship lost men.
So then they didn't know that you were alive until they got a letter from you.
Until they got
my
letter. Mm-hmm.
And how long was that?
It'd have to be when I got on a destroyer, because I never had anything.
So we're talking maybe even a month after it happened? They didn't know?
Probably right close to it, yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, wow. So you get put on a destroyer, which is very different from a battleship.
Oh, the regulations are altogether different. On the battleship, you had to stay in your own division, mm-hmm. your cleaning area, during working hours. You didn't go visit anybody, just a community, and you work just like you do on the outside. And then when you wanted to go someplace, you had to get permission to leave the area. You couldn't go down in your compartment. You had to stay in your working area for your 8 hours. Then when I went on a destroyer, everything's more relaxed. We didn't have to wear white shorts. We had dungarees to wear.
Uh-huh. And I'm just thinking here. I mean, maybe I should know better, because your birth certificate says you're 96, but you don't look 96.
Well, thank you.
And I'm thinking, it's hard enough for a guy to survive one of his ships sinking, let alone two, let alone the second one sinks on the third anniversary of the first one. I mean, this is kind of a hard-to-believe story you got here, Russ. But
yeah, I think a lot of people, I don't think people believe me sometimes when I tell them. Well, I didn't know it was December the 7th that day when we were sunk. And see what was happening. We had to abandon ship because of the explosions. People were in the water floating around. The kamikazes knocked out our boat. We had two boats that knocked out those boats. Some of the rafts were broken. People were just floating around in their life jackets. And so we went up topside, and we threw everything over it would float. And we had some stages. Those stages we used to paint the side of the ship. Mm-hmm. So we saved one stage, and we had one wounded man. So we put this wounded man, after we got in the water, we put him on the stage, and he just paddled away. But anyway, there's still three of us left. And I don't know where the other survivors, the current or the tide, just carrying them out. And so here we are, three of us together, and we were going around this Japanese-held island. We were headed out to sea, and I said, oh, my goodness. I thought, sure, the Japs would come and pick us up. They didn't. I think the current was so strong, probably they didn't have a boat to fight it. But anyway, pretty soon, there was nothing, no islands out there, nothing but the one we just left. And pretty soon, I saw a ship coming over the ride, and I was hoping it was American. It was. It was an American destroyer picked us up.
I want to ask you more about that, but it occurs to me that in those 3 years from December 7th, 1941 to December 7th, 1944, if you're on a destroyer in the Pacific, you saw a whole lot of other things that might stick with you. What were some of the other engagements that you guys were involved in?
We ran into two Japanese ships in 42. We opened fire on them. Of course, they overfired on us, too, but the first one we hit, I can't remember how many salvos we fired, but anyway, we missed. Just we went over it. Mm-hmm. So they fired another 5-gun salvo, and we hit the ship, and it exploded like an atomic bomb. There was, when we went over it, it was just nothing. No survivors whatsoever. So there's another one out there. It was a submarine tender. And, you know, tenders are their supply ships and then the machine shops and all
right.
that. And so we opened fire on it, and our projectile they explode, just throws this shrapnel all over the place. And we're trying to silence their guns. After we silence their gun, for some reason, they get them back in operation again. Hard to believe what those little Japanese can do, but they kept us going. However, we had to change over to armor-piercing shells to penetrate that steel.
Uh-huh.
Because those projectiles that hit that ship and they just explode.
And were you on a gun crew on the Mahan,
yes.
too?
Mm-hmm. 5-inch 38, first loader.
Uh-huh. That gets tiring after a while, doesn't it? Picking up those big old shells and over again?
54 pounds.
That's all?
Mm-hmm. But you got to make sure that you can't let them wobble around in there, because they'd go right up in the air, you know, when they ram it.
Yeah.
But anyway, I had to tell you about, we had a few seconds to just relax for a few seconds, you know, just intermittent. Well, you just, I thought, well, I better look around. You know, if you got any time, you look for aircraft. I'm always afraid of aircraft.
Uh-huh.
And I was looking back aft, because most of the aircraft always came up behind the stern of the ship.
Mm-hmm.
And I saw something go across my face. And I thought, is that a projectile? And I looked in the water, sure enough. I saw that splash. And then I saw some more splashes. And then that upset me.
How close did they come to you?
You know, they just went over our heads, yeah.
Didn't hit the ship.
Yeah.
But it got your attention.
Oh, yes. You can't believe it.
What were some of the other places that you guys were with that destroyer?
Well, let's see, down in New Guinea, we were up in Alaska. And when we were in Alaska, it was so foggy, you couldn't see the bow of the ship. That's how foggy it was up there. I don't know where we were, but I know we were out there looking for the Japanese.
Did you have any idea of how the war was progressing, or did it feel like this was going to go on forever and ever?
We were doing very well. I think we were just advancing so rapidly. I think we had the Japanese confused. That's the way I feel about it. I remember one time we took some army men aboard ship. We went 500 miles behind the enemy line. Of course, there were some APDs with us, converted destroyers from World War One. Mm-hmm. They converted them over to carry troops, and they had landing craft, LCVPs.
Yeah.
I think they carried 8. So anyway, 500 miles behind the Japanese line, making a landing at Los Negros. But we survived.
Did you get used to it? Did you get used to being fired at, to have enemy planes or enemy shells or torpedoes heading your way?
Well, we didn't want to go through it again, but you have to be brave. You can't just let yourself down and hide. You got to just stand out there and get with it. That's what we did. Everybody, it's remarkable what these sailors can do when they have to. Oh, I'll tell you about another battle. This is a good battle we were in. This a moonlight night, four of us destroyers operating off of New Britain.
Mm-hmm.
And we came under, I think they said 63 planes that were attacking us. So we laid a smoke screen. I don't know if I can tell you this story, if it'll go through or not. But we laid a smoke screen, and we were attacked by the Japanese aircraft all night long. And then we finally got fighter protection in the morning, and that's when it ceased. But anyway, we were completely black. And we had quite a few black men aboard ship. And they said, now you're one of us. we had more fun. Those guys had fun with us.
Because of all the smoke screen.
The smoke, yeah.
You guys were just covered in it.
We were covered black, yeah.
Uh-huh.
That was pretty good. That was a fun day there, I guess.
And for people, you know, some of our younger listeners especially, they might not realize that the military was still segregated at that point.
Yes.
Wasn't integrated
until
after World War II.
But aboard our ship, they were just like us. They loaded those guns. They passed ammunition.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Maybe this is a dumb question, but were you scared? Did you ever think, hey, I might not make it through this? I might not make it home to my family?
Many times.
Yeah?
Many times. It's just snap of a finger, you'd be gone. Or,
I mean, I've heard a lot of different answers. Some guys say, no, I was never afraid. I just knew I was going to get there. Another guy said, I can't believe I did.
I was always afraid.
Yeah?
We didn't want to die. Who wants to die? You know, when you think about it.
And you had seen enough that did.
Yeah, right. And they were still young men.
Was there something that gave you hope or kept you going or made you believe that you might make it?
When you do it so many times, it's just one of those things. You just roll it off your shoulders and be brave. And
what would you say was the hardest thing to deal with?
The dead.
You had to confront that on the first day of the war and many more times throughout the war. And as for that capture of Los Negros Island in the Admiralty Islands northeast of New Guinea that Mr. Russell and the destroyer USS Mahan were supporting in February of 1944, it was an often overlooked but strategically significant move that experts say shortened the Pacific War by at least a month. General Douglas MacArthur himself was there on the cruiser Phoenix. The Mahan was one of 9 destroyers that, along with those APDs Mr. Russell mentioned, carried troops troops to Los Negros, not knowing whether the island was really defended or not. So it was a stealthy, quick-strike invasion that carried a real risk of the unknown, but turned into a key success, and the destroyer Mahan was a big part of that. I have links to information about that battle for you at hometownheroesradio.com, and you'll also find connections to the Battle of Ormoc Bay, which would prove to be the last for the Mahan and two other American destroyers. Your destroyer was sunk December 7th, 1944, and it was just peppered with kamikazes. And this was before a lot of people even knew what a kamikaze was. I mean, it wasn't until a few months later that they really came in swarms in places like Okinawa and other spots there in the Pacific. Had you ever seen a kamikaze attack before that day?
In 42, we were in this battle of, we lost a carrier that day and a destroyer, and I saw a plane hit a destroyer. I just thought we shot it, or somebody shot it down and hit the destroyer. But I look back now, was it a kamikaze attack then? Makes me wonder.
Maybe. But this wasn't something you guys were really prepared to consider, that they would crash intentionally into your ship.
Well, one time we had this Baka bomber came in. It's just an open pit plane with a big bomb in front of it. And you could hear it flying around out there just above the water trying to hit a ship. And that's when your hair stands up on end. I don't know why. You know, we're so used to planes flying, you know, enemy aircraft coming in. But it's scary. In Japan, Baka means crazy.
Yeah. Very aptly named.
And I was down at the VFW the other day, and I was talking to a guy, and he's talking about the Baka bomber. And I said, I ain't know what you're talking about.
Yeah, because you live to tell the story. And we're going to dive into that story of the sinking of the destroyer USS Mahan on December 7th, 1944, 3 years to the day after Russ's ship, the Oklahoma, was lost at Pearl Harbor. You can find photos of this 96-year-old survivor at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. And we'll be right back after this. Remember when the bank gave you free checking and savings accounts, even making money for you when you kept your dollars there? Paul Leffler here to say, I've recaptured those days, and you can too with EECU. It's not a bank, it's a nonprofit credit union that just keeps growing and growing. The newest branch is in Tulare, and nearly a quarter million EECU members represent 10 different California counties. As little as $250 in a savings account earns you dividends. And access is so easy. 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And I haven't even told you what I love most about EECU. The credit union's support of causes up and down our area, like Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 800 veterans have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free because of the leadership and financial support of EECU. Ready to join the team yet? Call 1-800-538-3328. Paul Everett's RV Country has 8 locations in 5 western states, including Fresno and Indio, California, Bullhead City, Arizona, Laughlin, Nevada, Coburg, Oregon, right off the I-5, and 3 locations in Washington, Fife, Milton, and Mount Vernon. Over 55 years of experience serving the needs of RVers across the country and proud supporters of Hometown Heroes. Find a location near you by visiting rvcountry.com.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere on the air and online by Paul Everett's RV Country, with 8 locations in 5 western states.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, preparing you for the 75th anniversary of the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor with a man whose battleship was sunk that day and who, incredibly, lost his second ship, a destroyer, exactly 3 years later. In a bit, we're going to hear about 96-year-old David Russ Russell's free trip to the National World War II Memorial through the Honor Flight Network. His 20-year Navy career also included quite a bit of action in the Korean War and a chance to watch the coronation of Queen Elizabeth II through a porthole on his cruiser. But let's go back to December 7th, 1944, aboard that destroyer, the USS Mahan.
Well, we were making a landing on Ormoc, and of course we did our shelling, and then they sent us 26 miles north between Cebu and Leyte in case the Japanese ships came through. We could pick them up first, and that's when those 10 bombers came in just above the horizon.
Were you up topside?
Yeah, I was topside there. And then I had number three gun then. I was gun captain number three gun. And I could see him coming in. One of them hit forward in the ammunition handling room. And then one came at us, and it exploded right in front of us. It just threw debris all over us. Pretty soon, here come another one in, and trying to wipe us out. And I could see that pilot trying to get that plane down. I saw him, he was going down, and I just glanced, and I saw him churning up the water. And I don't know if he went down or what happened to him.
This is very unusual. A destroyer is not usually going to be targeted by a whole bunch of kamikazes. Usually they're going for a bigger target, right?
Like aircraft carriers.
Yeah. Know. So what do you think made you guys so special? You were just in the wrong place at the wrong time?
No, that's it.
And maybe you don't have time to think about it while you're on a gun crew and stuff's exploding around
you're
you.
You're so busy. You're so busy. Thank God we were so well trained. You may not like that training we went through, but boy, oh boy, it pays off.
Saved your life?
Yep. Yeah, you're right. Mm-hmm. After those kamikazes hit us, the old man announced abandoned ship. We had to abandon ship because so much, you know, everything was exploding, and that gasoline from those planes were burning. And one of them hit right there where the torpedo tubes are and knocked our mast and our stacks over. And we had two stacks at that time. And the torpedo tubes are right there, and that fire was right there. And that's probably the old man said, we better get out of here before they explode. Thank God those torpedo tubes did not explode.
You wouldn't be here.
None of us would be here. That's right. Yeah.
Yeah. So you get into the water. You told us before you got one of the wounded guys onto that stage, which turned into a raft for him, basically, kept him afloat. And there were three of you total that were together in the water?
Yeah, three plus the wounded man.
How long were you in the water?
People ask me that. It seemed like we were in there an awful long time. I don't know. I can't tell you how long I was in that water. But I said something about 4 hours. Some guys, no, I don't think so, but, you know.
Did you have a Mae West or a tube around your waist? Or what?
Just a life jacket.
And what time of day was this?
It was a very sunny day, but very nice day.
So at least you could see, but I don't know if you liked everything you saw. You saw land, but that's Japanese held, so you don't want to go there, right?
No way. I thought the Japanese were going to pick us up, what I thought.
Yeah. It just strikes me that that's got to be a really helpless feeling.
Well, when you're at sea like that, it is a helpless feeling. Are we going to survive? That's, you know, when you're talking about death, that is something different than aboard ship where you're fighting these guys. I don't know what it is, but...
So the four of you are floating for hours, and you don't know who's going to pick you up or if anybody's going to pick you up.
Right.
Were there any other hazards or concerns? Worried about sharks or anything like that?
I thought about sharks. Thank God I didn't see any sharks. In that warm water, you know, there's a lot of sharks.
And were you guys talking to each other this whole time?
Oh, yes. We stayed together.
What'd you talk about?
When we got off the ship, George Mower, he was living in Bothell, Washington. He says, you know what day this is? And I says, no. He says, this is December the 7th. I says, oh, no.
And that date had a little history.
Yeah.
Man.
Yeah, that was wow.
So tell us how it happened that you finally did get picked up. How did that all unfold?
When this story picked us up, we were worn out. And I think it's, you know, the stress. But anyway, that ship was under attack all the time we were on that thing.
Yeah, so that's not exactly everything's over and great now and you're safe.
Oh, yeah.
When you were in the water, did you have a conscious thought of what's going to happen here and am I going to get out of this? What are my parents going to think?
Everything goes through your mind, everything, yeah. You wonder about your folks and you wonder about the other guys.
So that must have been a pretty welcome sight when you saw that destroyer and you realized it was an American destroyer.
Very, yes. And they took a chance too, you know.
Yeah, because they're making themselves vulnerable to stop and pick you up.
That's right.
How exhausted were you? Did they have to pull you aboard? Were you able to climb up on your own?
They had their cargo nets over the side. They helped us aboard, yes. We couldn't do anything but just watch.
Your bodies were so exhausted from all that.
You just want to rest, yeah.
I'm sure you've thought about that a lot over the years.
Oh, every time I go to the bathroom and then get back to bed again, everything goes through your mind about the olden days, especially World War II.
I'm trying to figure a few things out here, Russ, and I'm thinking, okay, you survive Pearl Harbor when your ship doesn't and 429 guys go down with your ship. you go through these seven other invasions that you're supporting as a destroyer. Then that destroyer sinks. You survive floating in the water for hours and get picked up. And then you get to come home for a little survivor's leave. Did you really want to go back? What were you thinking? Why would you want, if this has almost killed you all these times and you've dealt with so many other guys getting killed, why would you want to stay in the Navy after the war was over?
Well, people I talked to said, stay in. There's no jobs. You know, all the jobs have been taken. And so I thought, well, I'll just extend my enlistment for 2 years. Well, I had so much time in. I said, where else can I retire in 12 years, you know, or 14 or whatever it was, you know.
So you stayed in for 20 years.
So I stayed 20. Mm-hmm. I get paid for 21.
Have you been back to Pearl Harbor?
Yes, several times.
What do you do when you go there?
Oh, you just look, that's about all. I did go aboard the Arizona, and I got to talk to a few people, which, you know, sort of, they want to know what happened.
And you look out, and you can see the outline of some of that ship, and you can see those little drops of oil coming to the surface.
See it? Mm-hmm.
What do you think about when you look at that?
I still think about all the wasted lives. Even on both sides, you know, the Japanese and the Americans both. And you, why?
You look up at that white wall with all the names on it, and you recognize a lot of those names.
A few, just because some of those guys I went through training with.
Have you ever wondered what, I mean, here you are at 96. You've got 75 years of memories that they never got to make. Have you ever wondered about what they would have done with their lives?
Well, they would have had a family probably, you know. They've been a grandpa by now, a great-grandpa.
The 75th anniversary of Pearl Harbor. There aren't too many of you guys left that were there. What should the rest of us who weren't there, what do we need to know? What do we need to remember?
Keep America strong. Watching these demonstrations on TV sort of bothers me. They want to take our way of life away from us, as far as I'm concerned. It hurts, you know. We fought a war to protect us and be free.
And another spot that I'm sure was powerful for you, the National World War II Memorial. You took a trip here a couple of years ago with...
Oh, that was a beautiful trip. Thanks to that young lady, Leah, there. It was beautiful.
You went South Willamette Valley Honor Flight.
That's right.
That's a long trip.
It's a long trip, but we all sit around reminiscing about what we did. And we had more fun talking.
You heard some interesting stories from some of the other vets.
Most of European stories.
Uh-huh. What did they say when you told them your story?
They just, you know, yeah.
You ever get that reaction? Is this guy for real? Did this all really happen?
Sometimes I think they don't believe me. That's the way I feel, you know.
Well, it is pretty hard to believe, isn't it?
Well, yeah, just like you say, it is hard to believe, yeah.
What'd you think of the World War II Memorial?
Oh, it was great. I love those states where they arrange that. Uh-huh.
You also saw part of that memorial, which is dedicated specifically to Pearl Harbor.
Yes, yeah.
You saw a portion of the president's speech?
Yes, And then all those stars up there represent 100,000?
406,000 Americans who died in the war. That's what those stars represent.
Yeah, that was it, yeah.
What'd you think about when you looked at those stars?
It's just like when we were out at the Arlington. Why? All of them, most of them were killed in wartime, yeah.
Yeah, and somehow you weren't. I mean, you could have been one of those tombs or one of those stars.
I could have, right?
So how do you explain that? Why do you think you survived December 7th, 41, December 7th, 44, and all those other times?
I don't know. And look, I'm still alive. And why? There's something out there doing something to us. I don't know what it is.
Do you think that? Do you think that somebody was protecting you?
There's something out there protecting us. You know, we had a lot of problems with our guns sometimes. They wouldn't work, or something wouldn't work aboard ship. And every time we went into action, that ship was perfect. Everything worked perfect. Now, why? Can you explain that one?
I think there's a lot of unexplainable when it comes to your story.
Yeah, everything's unexplainable when it comes. Yeah, right.
And I know we're bouncing around, but back to your honor flight experience. So you got to see all that back in D.C., the World War II Memorial, other monuments.
The one I really loved was that Korean. You know, when you go into battle, there's something about the guy's eyes, the fright, I think it is. Am I going to be shot or wounded or what? Yeah, I've seen that quite a few during World War II.
That look in people's eyes?
That special look in their eyes, yeah.
Do you have that look in your eyes?
Probably. I think we all go through something like that. It's probably from fright. Like you say, are we going to survive this? Because, you know, after all, we're just survivors. That's all we are.
with a story to tell.
We got into Baltimore. Goodness, all the people. Congratulations. And a lot of military were there.
Uh-huh.
And then when we came back to Portland, wow, what a celebration that was. People congratulated, shaking our hand. Of course, they did that back in Baltimore, too. But I've never had that happen to me before. I've just, you know, I'm just a old GI, you know.
What did that do for you? How did that make you feel?
Oh, it's different. I don't know just quite how to explain it, but why are they doing that for me? You know, I'm just, like I said, I'm just nobody, but it sure makes you feel good. Everybody wanting to shake our hand. You can't shake everybody's hands. All I did was just bow to them like the Japanese bowed to us, you know, after World War II.
Did that make you feel that maybe somebody understands what you guys did and still cares about it?
That's sort of hard to believe people really know what we went through. I don't think anybody knows what we went through. They have to experience it themselves.
Well, I guess the next best thing is listening to you tell them about it, tell them your story and some of the things that you went through.
Hopefully it sinks in. Mm-hmm.
I think so. But I don't think you should use the word sink. You and that word don't have a good history.
Anyway, I think hopefully they believe me.
Uh-huh.
That's the thing. You know, when you tell a story, do they believe me?
Well, I think everybody listening today believes you. And I want to echo what all those people at the Portland airport were trying to say to you when you got home from your honor flight. Thank you for serving our country.
That was it. That big thank you. Yeah, that's a good way of putting it. That was a big thank you.
Well, I think we should hear from one of those people who put that big thank you together. Lee Bach is with South Willamette Valley Honor Flight here in Oregon. She's gotten to know Mr. Russell quite well over the last couple years. And I've got to ask you, Lee, when you first heard Russ's story, could you believe it?
Blew my mind. I've heard a lot of great stories. I just recently went on my 8th honor flight trip, and so I've heard some really incredible stories and met some real heroes. And Russ is one of my all-time favorites. Just who he is, what he went through, his perspective just blows my mind.
It is really incredible to go through what he went through on December 7th and then have another ship from underneath him. And on that honor flight, you probably got to see a different side of him too. What really stood out about the kind of man that he is?
He is so humble. You know, again and again, he will argue with you if you call him a hero, but I will keep arguing with him on that. He feels like he didn't do anything special, that the guys that didn't make it home, that they're the real heroes. But like I said, I will keep arguing with him about how special he is and how much of a hero he is. What really drew me in about Russ, there's a couple things. For one, he reminds me very much of my grandfather, which served in the Army during World War II in Germany. So there was an instant connection for me to be drawn to him. And then he's just so happy and jovial and engaging, smart and funny. He's just this incredible person, and I just feel so honored to know him.
Is there one element of his story that is the most amazing to you, or just makes you shake your head and say, wow, how did that happen?
His Pearl Harbor story. My family's vacation spot when I was growing up was Hawaii. Very blessed to be able to do that. And I remember I believe I was 14, and we went to Pearl Harbor Arizona Memorial and, you know, took all of that in. And that made a huge impact on me as a young teenager. I would have never, never imagined that I would meet someone and get to become friends and have this really special person in my life that was there on that day, that survived and went on to continue to fight for our country. I mean, this man showed up when the world needed him most, and I'm just blown away by him. Absolutely. He is an incredible human being. Oh. He's a survivor.
Yeah, I don't think anyone can question that, right?
Yeah.
And you mentioned being on 8 honor flights with South Willamette Valley Honor Flight here in Oregon. So you've interacted with a whole lot of veterans. What has that taught you?
There's probably not enough time to cover what it's taught me, but probably in a nutshell, I'm humbled by these men and women, by their selfless service again and again and again to protect our country, to protect the world, to protect our rights and freedoms. And they're everyday people that showed up and got the job done, didn't quit. And I just think that is a beautiful testimony to not just the greatest generation, because I've been on flights now with Korean War veterans, and we just recently took Vietnam veterans. These men and women show up and get the job done. No questions asked. No complaints. They show up and serve us all. Both my parents raised me for a deep appreciation for our military, their respect. And so that's just always been part of my life. I've raised my daughters that way. But to be able to, you know, spend the weekend and then outside of those honor flights to get to know the veterans, to spend time with them once we get home, to form these friendships and these bonds has just made my appreciation for who they are greater than what I had before. Being part of Honor Flight. It's just an honor and privilege. I would encourage anybody that wants to give a gift to themselves, because it is. It is a privilege for me to go on these flights. People will say, oh, you're so amazing to do that. And I'm like, no, I'm actually very selfish because this is such a treat for me. It is just all about showing up and hanging out with these people that are mind-blowing to me. So it's very selfish, but it is such a treasure. One of my favorite things in my whole life I've ever been a part of. And I would just encourage people to get involved in any way possible. It just pays you back more than anything you could have ever given. You get back.
I don't think anybody could have said that better. Thank you, Lee Bach of South Willamette Valley Honor Flight. Wherever you're listening today, you can find an Honor Flight hub near you by going to honorflight.org. And I promised our 96-year-old Pearl Harbor survivor would get that last word. So, Russ, one more question for you.
Someone came up to you, and they don't know anything about Pearl Harbor. They don't know why it should matter, why it's even worth recognizing or having this big observance that they're going to have on Oahu that day. Why would you tell them that it does matter? What would you tell them that they need to remember about it?
You got to remember, we could go through that again if they're not prepared for it. We got to be prepared.
So let's remember that, shall we? On December 7th and every other day on the calendar, go to hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page if you want to see how youthful Mr. Russell looks at age 96. Thanks so much for listening today. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free. If you spent much time listening to Hometown Heroes, you've probably heard veterans from all over America talking about the mission of the Honor Flight Network, taking World War II veterans free of charge to see their memorial in Washington, D.C.
I wanted to see it. I've always wanted to see it since they built it. And to see all those guys there that did survive, and then they get emotional. Pretty soon you get emotional, too.
I tell you, that Honor Flight, I just can't believe what a wonderful deal it is.
Everywhere people came up to us, military guys and civilians, and wanted to shake our hands and thank us for all we did. I kept saying there were 16 million of us, you know, and I only did a little piece. But it was just an emotional high.
When it comes to our men and women in uniform, all gave some, and some gave all. A reality underscored as veterans visit the World War II, Korea, and Vietnam memorials and Arlington National Cemetery.
All those white crosses go into your heart. You just know that there's good guys there, but they had to die. For what? So you could live.
And while they are still living, Honor Flight gives the rest of us a chance to express our gratitude. Won't you encourage the World War II veterans in your life to put in applications for this all-expenses-paid journey to their memorial?
It does something for each of us who have been veterans who go back, whether we're a guardian or whether we're honored as a guest on the flight. It completes our life, really. Gives us a sense of fulfillment that we weren't able to have before, I think.
If you live near me in Central California, find Central Valley Honor Flight at cvhonorflight.org. Wherever you're listening, there's a hub in your area, and you can find it on the national website, honorflight.org. Sign up a veteran, volunteer to help, or donate to this important and time-sensitive mission. It's amazing what it means to these members of our greatest generation.
I'm telling you, they make you feel so good and so wonderful. Let me tell you, I can't preach enough about this. You listening?
The manner in which we were treated and greeted and acted toward was just awesome. It made me believe that the people of the United States are just wonderful.
Time is of the essence. Team up with Honor Flight today and help give our veterans one more tour with honor.
And for those of you listening to the podcast version at hometownheroesradio.com, Mr. Russell had a few more stories that didn't fit into our radio time. So here are some of those thoughts now, including his witnessing of the sinking of the aircraft carrier USS Hornet in the Battle of the Santa Cruz Islands in late October 1942, his duty during the Korean War, and more. And after you listen to the rest, don't forget to catch Russ in the PBS special, Pearl Harbor, USS Oklahoma, The Final Story.
I finally found out how many invasions we were in, you know, where we land, where we went in and we did our bombarding and then the troops would come in. I was in a total of seven. But a lot of times we'd follow these aircraft carriers.
Right.
And I'd try to count how many planes would leave the carriers and how many would return after they made them go attack something. But it's pretty hard to do because we always had fighter protection around us. Pretty soon you quit doing that. Well, one time we came under attack. Hundreds of planes came in, and we lost the Hornet. I think it was a Hornet. Yeah, the Hornet and the Enterprise. We're making these high-speed maneuvers. And when those carriers make a turn, you think the ships are going to capsize. But all the planes that were still on deck slid right off, right into the water. That was after that, I think they made sure they were all secured before.
What'd you do during the Korean War?
I'll tell you about the Korean War. We were in Incheon before the war broke out.
Oh, really?
We got orders to go back to the States. So we proceeded back to the States, and a day before we got into Pearl Harbor, a war broke out. Of course, we knew war was going to break out in Korea. I took the train from Incheon up to Seoul, and they had all these Army vehicles and Marine guards on the railroad tracks all the way up there and back.
Before the war started.
Just before the war started.
Yeah.
So anyway, the war broke out, and the next day we went into Pearl Harbor, took on provisions, and right back out to Korea again. Out in Korea, we would protect the carriers. Once in a while, we'd have to go in and do a little bombardment. You know, the Army or the Marine Corps needed a little help.
Mm-hmm.
Most of the time, after they went up above the DMZ zone, we operated out of Wonsan.
Uh-huh.
And Wonsan, you know, that's where the most of the evacuation took place when they left North Korea.
Uh-huh. Right.
We did quite a bit of bombardment. And
anything else from your 20 years in the Navy that you look back on?
Well, I'll tell you about Shanghai. When Mao took over Shanghai, we were in Shanghai at the time.
Really?
And so they gave us orders to sink cover, all hands sink cover, and proceed out to the Yangtze River. And so we went out the Yangtze River, dropped anchor, and we flew the battle flag.
Really?
You haven't seen a battle flag. Oh, when we came under an attack on our Japanese ships, the old man put up the battle flag. Oh, my goodness, you haven't seen anything till you see a battle flag. That thing is so huge. I don't know what it is. It's just everything just, you know, just puts goosebumps on you and you see it.
When you see it, when you're on that ship and it goes up, it's like pumping you full of something?
Yeah, it does. And I don't know why we flew the battle flag, because I guess we're in enemy territory at that time, yeah.
Yeah.
I put 2 years in Europe, too, you know.
What were you doing there?
Operating out of Korea. I didn't like Korea. I didn't want to go back to Korea, so I asked for a transfer. And so there was a cruiser going in commission, so I got to put it in commission. And we went to Europe. We went to the coronation in England. I got to see the Queen when she was a young girl.
Uh-huh.
Through a porthole.
I like to ask guys this question, and maybe it's not the easiest one, but 96 years old, that's a lot of life to look back on. Is there something that you would say you're most proud of or maybe most thankful for?
I'm very thankful I survived World War II. I have to say I'm thankful I joined the Navy when I did, because I am the news commentator about the American...
Tom Brokaw?
Yeah, Tom Brokaw, you know.
Greatest generation.
Now look, the generation today is different. Of course, we were brought up poor. We never had any money. We never made money in the service. Look back now, in the service, you were always poor, because you didn't make it... Like, see, when I went in the service, I was making $30 a month. Mm-hmm. And then after I got out of graduated there, I went up to 36. And then I made passed my test, and I got made 54. This is before the war. Mm-hmm. Then after the war started, I went up to 60, got another pay rate. We got a pay raise during the war, too. It wasn't much, probably $2. See, when I retired in 60, I think I was getting $100 and some dollars a month. I never had any money until I got out of the service and started working, yeah.
Well, and when you're talking about money in the service, it strikes me that you probably still have some of your money underwater at Pearl Harbor.
No, I was broke. But you know, after they raised the ship, they sent some my locker. They got into my locker, because all their clothes are extensive with your name on them. Mm-hmm. And they sent some little trinkets I had. They sent them to my mom. Yeah.
You mentioned earlier, because I asked you how you felt after December 7th, and you talked about the sentiments against the Japanese then, and how badly people wanted to go over there and defeat them and kill them. And you made the statement that your perspective is very different now about the Japanese people. When did that change? Was there a moment that kind of became clear to you? That
I think when I first went into Japan, just right after the war ended, you know, and the people had nothing to do with this. And the kids would come out. Mm. The kids. And then pretty soon, you get acquainted with the elderly people. Mm-hmm. And they always bowed to us. Thank you, thank you. They always thanked us. But when I saw General MacArthur up there in the Daiichibu in Tokyo, those Japanese bowing to him, you know, I thought, mm-hmm. how remarkable, you know. They think a lot of our leader, you know.
So it didn't take long for you to get over that.
Oh, no. No, as soon as I met those people, they treated us so good. And let's see, when the Americans went into Japan, they cut up all the guns. No, nobody had guns then. Oh, they took acetylene torches and just cut up all the guns. They took all the machinery out of the warehouses. The Army really cleaned that place up. So nowadays, when they fight a war, I think you have to get permission to shoot somebody. It's different.